Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is Episode 2, March 12th, 2017. This week we will cover anarchist activity from March 4th to the 11th. We intend for this podcast to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. We hope curious listeners give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. You can find this podcast at podcast.anarchistnews.org and most of the citations at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. On our minds this weekend, the Native Nations March in Washington, D.C. Because the hardest lessons have to be learned over and over again, yesterday the Standing Rock Sioux Nation and grassroots indigenous leaders marched in prayer and action on Washington, D.C. and marched from the Army Corps of Engineers building to Lafayette Square. Quote, "The Native Nations Rise March was organized by Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, Native Organizers Alliance, and Indigenous Environmental Network to support the Standing Rock fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline and raise awareness to other indigenous issues. Thanks to the participation of protesters, the march generated headlines and raised the spirits of Native activists and their allies. Water is life, and we're going to fight for what's rightfully ours," said Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians Chairman Aaron Payment. "We're going to keep bringing information, so they're going to have to do something. We're going to remind them of their trust, responsibilities, and our treaty rights to protect our natural resources and sacred sites," end quote. You can find more information at the IndianCountryMediaNetwork.com/news site. A central question to having a radical notion about the world and the world you'd prefer to live in is, who are you in that world and in that notion? This is especially true because the world, this world, doesn't allow you a lot of flexibility in who you get to be and your capacity to have notions of your own. The internet has been an interesting intervention here because, while in some ways it doesn't mean a thing, for many people, the internet has been taken entirely at face value as a place where freedom can begin. Here is a place where you get to define yourself from a blank slate. Are you a black masked rioter? Are you a person with an integrated plan about every aspect of how a future society should be organized? Are your ideas more important than how they get put into practice? There are several different anarchist approaches to this question about how to put radical notions into practice, as many as there are different ideas about how to test those ideas. The part of this that I'd like to focus on this week is whether these different perspectives have different amounts of merit based on whose mouth they come out of, rather than the ideas themselves. Last week, we discussed a critique of the Black Bloc that attempted to place it within the measure of privileged politics. While clearly the author had a liberal bias of status politics, the question of whether it's possible to show support for a community while remaining anonymous is interesting. Their extra dig that while white bodies will take measure to prevent their own arrest, while possibly leaving colored bodies to be arrested, is also interesting. What does solidarity look like if you aren't interested in, and are in fact hostile to, the state that does the measuring? I don't want these editorials to just ask probing questions, so I'll answer mine from the last paragraph. I don't think it's possible for the Black Bloc, full well knowing it isn't a singular thing, to show solidarity for a group while remaining separate from that group. I don't think that that's usually the goal of the individual members of the Black Bloc either. I think they, in the hypothetical scenario the original critic is implying, are showing the limited solidarity that outsiders are capable of showing when something terrible happens to people you feel empathy for, but nothing more substantial than that. I also don't think the criticism that outsiders can only show outsider levels of support is particularly fair or interesting. There are many other flavors of people who are perhaps not as performative as the Black Bloc that are also outsiders showing empathy. I rarely hear the Black Bloc express a moralistic superiority over those other empathy showers. I hear plenty of moralism against those who do not perform empathy at empathy events, but that's a topic for another time. The rule of thumb that I think is missing from the liberal state apologist critic is that one should not judge others by their own criteria. If one thinks that solidarity should look like getting arrested, and judges those who do not get arrested, one has drawn a clear line around the kind of solidarity they are interested in. The critic is correct that those with privilege are not going to magically shed it because of their own criteria. but there are plenty of other examples of privilege being shed. These stories are interesting, but are mostly not because of politics, as much as the individual stories of how politics gets translated into lived human experiences. Usually that is not by judgment, shame, or acrimony. For my own part, the part of the critic's attitude that I agree with most is the same as the central question of radical notions. The world does not allow one a lot of flexibility in participating in it. This means we have to create our own ways of being radical and of having notions of acting in the world. Sometimes that looks like finding people who we find attractive, charismatic, and doing what they do, and sometimes it looks like something else entirely. What's new this week? Chilean anarchists Monica Caballero and Francisco Solar arrived this morning at Santiago's International Airport after having been expulsed from Spanish custody and deported back into their home country. They had been charged under the Spanish anti-terrorism legislation for the alleged bombing of the Basilica de Pilar Church in Zaragoza in 2013. Also new this week, the Bay Area Anarchist Book Fair 2017 edition is going to be postponed. It was scheduled to happen April 22nd and has been pushed to the fall, September 16th. Location issues were cited as the reason for the move. The Melbourne Anarchist Communist Group issued an announcement for International Women's Day called Celebrating a New Revolution. And a new clandestine group called Anarquistas El Combate made a call for autonomy in Colombia. Upcoming events include the Orange County Anarchist Book Fair happening at the Universalist Unitarian Church in Anaheim, California. The New York City Anarchist Book Fair is happening, it's the 11th annual, is happening on May 13th, Saturday, at Judson Memorial Church in Manhattan. And the 9th annual Humboldt Anarchist Book Fair is happening April 29th at the Manila Community Theater in Arcata, California. This week has been a sort of remarkable week in terms of publications and podcasts. This week, if you count our brand new podcast, there have been six ostensibly anarchist podcasts released. The first one that was basically released a little over a week ago is the first episode of a podcast called Horizontal Hostility. It basically seems to be a group of five people sitting around and talking about issues around encryption. Their audience appears to mostly be beginners. This episode, they focused a lot of energy on analyzing the Rise Up kerfuffle that happened about 3 months ago, or people started to hear about 3 months ago. What happened was basically Rise Up has what's called a warrant canary, which is basically a document that if you don't update periodically, it demonstrates that you have probably been served a warrant by an alphabet federal agency. And so it's a sort of warning that if it's not updated, you know, act appropriately. Rise Up's warrant canary fired, I think, in December. And this podcast mostly talked about the consequence of 3 months later, Rise Up basically explained their action. And the participants of this podcast talked about pros and cons of the Rise Up action, with some being quite critical and many others being quite supportive. Anarchy Radio, of course, it's a weekly anarchist podcast hosted by John Zerzan. This week was basically like the best kind of episode you would get if you like Anarchy Radio. John shared a piece of his writing. It's a new essay called Death. As you can imagine, he thinks that death in civilization is bad. He talked about other bad things. He also talked about resistance and had a few callers. Another brand new podcast called The Anarchists is a group of ex-Redditors. Their names blurred together. They hope to make their podcast a weekly podcast that helps publicize actions that don't get covered in other news. This episode didn't necessarily accomplish that task, but good luck for them in the future. The Ex-Worker, which is the Crime Think podcast, episode 55, the J20 protests and beyond, anarchists bring in the Trump era. And finally, the Final Straw Radio, which is in fact a radio program similar to Anarchy Radio, but it derives from a radio show, and so it's a clean podcast. This episode, In It to Win It, an interview with members of the Black Rose Federation. Topic of the week. What was your path to becoming an anarchist? Was it because of the influence of a subculture like punk, hippie, or activism? Was it the influence, positive or negative, of a particular relative or teacher? Was it through long hours reading books in the library? Was it through the influence of a friend or group of friends? Was it through a series of troubles with the law? Or was it through spending excessive amounts of time on the internet? And was the process of becoming an anarchist a gradual thing for you, slowly drifting leftward or rightward until you fell off the political map into the weird and wonderful world of anarchy land? Was it an instant transformation, an epiphany of sorts? Do you feel as though you were always an anarchist, and the process of becoming one was really just finding a name for what you already were? How much of this transformation do you think was the result of personal, intellectual pursuits? How much of it was a result of some kind of social interaction, be it conversation or argument with others, or going along with your friends? What do you think motivated this change? A desire to meet some emotional needs? A desire for logical consistency? Or something else? What are your thoughts?
I found anarchy by accident. I was a disappointed, disaffected, liberal, and second-wave feminist. And I had been raised that way. And I wanted something different. Their political conclusions, their hatred for the system and its inherent flaws because of the patriarchy was fine with me. But the conclusion that we just need to take it away from the men and do it right, we'll make it better, didn't sit with me well. And so I was looking for something. I was in my early 20s. But well into being into my, on the path to being into my mid-20s. And so I was old for anarchy at the time. And I met a boy, like so many of us do. And he was already an anarchist. And we spent lots of long hours having conversations that were mostly just about him sharing ideas and perspective on history, philosophy, even the most mundane things. And it being different from what I had known, from my understanding of the world. And it creating more questions and creating more conversation. And I felt like it was a constant chase for more information.
What was the part you did alone?
I read alone. But almost all of my reading was guided. Actually, my anarchist education was a little skewed, because one of my mentors, for lack of a better word, was 10 plus years my senior. And a lot of the basic entry-level 101 books that people stumble into and read because it's what in front of them, he discouraged me from reading. Oh, no, that's not a good book. Read this instead. It was years later before I would go back and read some of those texts, and some of them I never read.
What were your three influential texts?
I walked the path of the Situationists, for sure. The Society of the Spectre had a huge impact on me. I didn't read it until much, much later, but Emma Goldman's autobiography was...
I think a lot of people would have that in their top
three. Was powerful. And I had been an anarchist for a decade before I ever picked it up. And, Pacifism is Pathology, World Churchill's book.
Oh, really?
That was really powerful for me. I'm not sure it's appropriate to say that that's an anarchist text, but it was in a mix of other books at that time. I'll think of other things. That's just what's popped in my head at the moment.
Yeah, my story is probably more common. I was involved in the punk rock world, and then as I became sort of a little older, late teens, it became very important to be, to sort of take a stand on Nazi skinheads. And I associated myself with a variety of skinhead that doesn't really exist, especially on the West Coast, but I associated myself with like a New York style skinhead and became a sharp skinhead in my late teens. And
sharp stands for something, right?
Yeah, skinheads against racial prejudice.
Right.
And at that time, there was no such thing as Antifa. It was called, it became called ARA, Anti-Racist Action. But so I did some politics under that banner and sort of learned a little bit about what politics meant, and sort of came to the conclusion on my own without a conversation with other people that the way that I sort of thought about it was that, like, social reforms, like better medical and you know, whatever, like the good things the government ostensibly could provide us, that I felt as though those things were impossible. In other words, the likelihood of them ever coming was was basically zero. And so if I were going to think about, work, orient myself in the direction of these impossible things, then I might as well orient myself towards the actual things that I want rather than the partial measures of socialist reforms. And so that's when I became, at least inside my head, an anarchist. Around that time, I was moving to San Diego, largely because of my organizing around racists. And I was really lucky to move to San Diego because I was immediately exposed to this place called the Che Cafe. And I spent the next 2 years learning from grad students and really being in the environment of the Che Cafe, which was a vegan, collectively run restaurant where you really got to practice anarchism. And so those 2 years, you know, were incredibly important to me and, yeah, shaped who I became.
Yeah, in the early 2000s, I moved into a punk anarchist group house in the Mission with one of my oldest high school friends, Chuck, and became good friends with one of his best friends, Mike. And Chuck had been an anarchist in high school and had been a punk, but Chuck and I didn't talk about politics very much, so I didn't really understand what that meant. I liked the punk aesthetic, but I was a hip-hop kid, and the fact that when you were listening to the song, you didn't understand the words didn't connect for me with punk rock. And that was that. I had lots of conversations with Chuck and Mike and just lived in this world where everyone, anarchy was the baseline of acceptance. And it was interesting to be around people who talked about what they wanted from the world, as opposed to being around people who spoke in measures and legislation and acts and a whole generation and a section of people who really, really wanted to follow in the footsteps of the victories of the civil rights movement, which those victories always seemed terribly hollow and
partial
and insulting. And, you know, from beginning to end, nobody got anything of what they wanted. I suppose desegregating schools, but other than that, it was just, you know, where are our victories? What can we walk away with? And that always left a bad taste in my mouth. And it was a whole different experience to be around a world of people who didn't see the world in those terms. And I was excited about politics again. I was excited about actually demanding what I wanted and feeling like there was a place where I could stand and hold that ground and do that and force the world to engage with me.
What's the difference between your anarchism now versus your anarchism then? Especially those first couple years?
Well, there was a lot of disillusionment, for sure.
Like what?
I remember going to an anarchist action in San Francisco. I don't even remember what it was for at this point. And watching people march and chant and hold signs and speakers, and realizing that this felt exactly like every liberal feminist event I had ever been to in my entire life. And I don't know what I expected, but I expected it to be different.
Although, I guess if maybe you met anarchism later, it would have been a bit different, because it would have been more like a Black Bloc, right?
I suppose that's true. Yeah, I mean, I found the anarchy pre-Seattle. And I remember being excited by Seattle and not knowing politics could look like that. So,
how have you changed? Like, what is anarchism for you today?
I don't actually believe that there is any room to demand what you want. You're not actually in dialogue with the powers that be. And you carve out your space and take what you can and make the world, put out in the world what you want to be in the world. So surround yourself with the politics that you want to live. Because nobody else is going to give it to you. Nobody else is going to make room for you to have whatever it is that you want that isn't what everybody else wants.
Yeah, I think that when I think about my my path, you mentioned disillusionment, and I think that the best book that sort of speaks to that disillusionment and that is almost like a necessary book for people to check out if they're going to make it through is that book, Letters of Insurgents.
Absolutely.
And partially that's because that book talks about disillusionment in far more crass and brutal terms than we experience here in North America. But also, I feel like it gives a path out, you know, and that path mm-hmm. somehow is like a path of understanding or a path of like, it's to look steely-eyed into the abyss. And I would describe my own attitude now is much more childlike than it was 25, 30 years ago. Like, I continue to revert back to a discussion around imagination, and that I feel as though imagination continues to bring me a lot of joy, and it's why I continue to associate with this thing called anarchism that, by and large, isn't necessarily creative, joyful, interesting, hopeful. But I feel as though, you know, because it's been so many years, I've sort of, I don't know, I feel like I'm on the inside of it rather than the outside. And so that's, I think, how it's different for me.
I at some point I started to become really intentional about the conversations that I was having and the people that I was having them with.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I'm fortunate enough to live in a world where I'm surrounded by smart people having interesting conversations who laugh out loud at themselves and anything else that's funny. And there's that's where the joy and the creativity is, for sure.
Are you open to meeting new anarchists?
I don't have a problem meeting new anarchists. I've tabled at some book fairs that are very much geared toward young, new people who come up with the most basic of questions. And I actually think it's an interesting exercise to try to have those conversations with someone who doesn't have any of the touchstones that I have.
The cultural touchstones.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But let's be clear that there's a difference between meeting them and investing in them.
Having them in your life.
To an extent, because I've been around a long time now, and you know, at some point you can't even keep a list anymore of the people that have come and gone through anarchy land and, you know, never to be seen or heard from again. So age brings caution.
Thank you.
That aspect. Thank you.
Opinion and analysis. As we know, every week there are quite a few opinions expressed in the anarchist space. This section of the A-News podcast is an attempt to highlight some of those opinions and then to dig into others at depth. The blog Destroy Everything wrote a provocative article called "Is It Fascism Yet?" which basically interrogates the question of what is the definition of fascism and whether or not we, in fact, can be characterized as living within that definition today. The blog Ding Politic shared an essay called "Anarchist Social Movements Do Not Exist," that is a sort of hostile interrogation of whether or not there are such things as social movements that could in fact be called anarchist. The Kurdish question shared a nice informative article called Experiences in Rojava, Interview with an Anarchist YPG Volunteer. And finally, the Void Network shared Oh My Trump on the Figures of the Global Civil Conflict. In depth this week, we're going to talk about the communique from anarchists Monica Caballero and Francisco Solar, mentioned in the updated news section. We're going to talk about a collaborative project for 420. And finally, we're going to read El Arante's Dispatches from Greece 3, Notes from 2 Months in Exarchia. So we talked a little bit about that Monica and Francisco were sort of expelled from Spain, released back to Chile, where they're from. And we're going to talk a little bit about, or we're going to read from their article that was reprinted from Contra Info. And, well, mostly I share this because of how different their attitude is than a North American perspective. In the struggle to break with the establishment, we look for and create relationship forms that are contrary to imposition and authority. Forms that help us feel comfortable in order to develop autonomously in our proposals and acts of daily confrontation. With this feeling, we understand affinity represents the most suitable way for anarchist relations, and that it's not the fruit of empty slogans repeated until satiation, but the result of practices and shared visions that have helped generate long-lasting bonds of passionate friendship and intimacy that go beyond the simple bonds of just friends. The trust and care that comes from feeling and knowing that the ideas of permanent rebellion are the sustenance and strength of affinity helps build and develop anti-authoritarian practices. In turn, these ideas are inseparable from our choice of life, the option that reinforces what we plan and how it's to be done. It's through these relationships that we grow individually and have the ultimate possibility of acts with no strings attached, which impedes the creation of bureaucratic and authoritarian behavior, cutting off the concentration of power. Critics of this position have signaled that this form makes it impossible to influence social reality and that it turns anarchism into a ghetto. Our response is that we don't understand anarchism as a political party that uses all of its strategies to increase numbers for the purpose of achieving hegemony. We think that the means must be coherent with the ends, as it would be contradictory to claim total liberation otherwise. For us, anarchism is, above all, a tension where individuals' initiative plays a central role, not a production. And then later in the same essay. Throughout the operations of Pandora and Pinata, these are the names of state agency attacks mostly against anarchists in Spain, specifically Barcelona. The state has, as previously mentioned on several occasions, attempted to attack ideas and practices that are radically different than it, as evidenced by the fact that none of the imprisoned friends are accused of concrete actions. What they've tried to do is punish a way of living. The option of struggle against the established order and permanent anti-authoritarian activity that, more or less, has influenced many spaces and aspects of the milieu. Therefore, the continuing transition on the path of rupture represents a small victory that demonstrates that the state can show us its worst face, but it can't bend us. In this regard, we believe that solidarity with the friends imprisoned must necessarily be the transgressor and on the offensive, breaking away from the discourse of pessimism and victimization. The utilization of all our creative, limited only by our anarchic principles, is fundamental in strengthening our solidarity. In the war against domination, all actions are necessary. So again, that's from Monica and Francisco, who thankfully have escaped the Spanish state and are now back in their home in Chile. I also wanted to highlight this project called a collaborative project for 420. What I like about it is that it tries to engage with something that is definitely not anarchist, which is April 20th, for those of you who don't know, is also a day, at least in the U.S., and I guess in Canada, because this person's writing from Canada, where people publicly appreciate marijuana. I believe the 420 is from a statute, like perhaps in California, for getting arrested for pot possession. So this person, and obviously I'll mostly let them speak for themselves, but this person is essentially trying to integrate how could there be an anarchist intervention into the events that happen around the 420 date. Usually it's like parties in parks with lots of blankets and people smoking out on blankets. So let's explore this. I'm not against weed. The very notion of being against weed is, of course, fucking dumb. But what I thought was cool on 420 in 2013 wasn't the weed itself, but the sight of lots of people having fun with their friends, some of them high school age, and maybe less jaded or worn out than I was already at the age of 23. I liked the blatant criminality of the whole thing, the good, clean, fun nature of it. That's what life should be like all the time. There can be no final answer to the question, how do we determine for ourselves what we need, and how to actually make it happen. Final, complete, ostensibly perfect answers are for Marxists and worse. Rather than pretending to have articulated the anarchist position on weed or whatever, me and my friends think it would be better to just hear what people are thinking about freedom and domination, about Trudeau, weed addiction, counterculture, cognitive self-determination, disability, the war on drugs, actually existing weed capitalism in Colorado, how getting stoned at work is an act of sublime rebellion, ways to fuck with Mark and Jody Emery, solutions for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that involve the desert blooming with Kush, and whatever else. For my part, I'm planning to go to the 420 gathering this year, both to have a good time, to make anarchists visible in such a space, and maybe to contribute something helpful in the event that the cops act like pricks. Hopefully some friends will come with me, and ideally we'll have a zine that we'll feel good about handing out to strangers. Perhaps some people will go off, read some things from the zine, and come back to ask us about it and talk to us. Maybe it'll do all sorts of things. But first, it needs to exist. The TLDR, I want to do a zine about weed and anarchy for general distribution on 420. So I like this because it's, of course, you know, a big, broad internet plea for help. But it also talks about a topic that anarchists in general don't talk about, or they just sort of nod and say, sure, smoke weed if you want. But this actually attempts to try to do something about it. Always very nice. Finally here, I'm going to read from the Dispatches from Greece 3, Notes from 2 Months in Exarchia, by Paul Z. Simons. Come and get food, motherfuckers! The call, in a slight accent, echoes down the marble steps of the squat. The daily common meal is ready. In many ways, this call for food encapsulates the nature of squatting in Greece. There is a complex relationship between squatters, a familiarity born of a shared life and shared enemy. There's also a challenge, a slight but perceptible pressure to maintain relentless social contestation, always working, pushing towards the idea. The results can take multiple forms, actions, demos, art, theater. A number of the squatters use art as a weapon. They paint, they build installations, they alter and manipulate the urban environment, joyfully. They plot, they plan actions, they look for openings in the armor of the social enemy to strike and cause harm. They speak of love and hatred with no embarrassment. There is camaraderie. Days spent talking, laughing, shadowboxing, spray painting, wheat pasting on the walls of the squat. One of my most profound memories is hearing laughter ringing through the building as the younger squatters horse around late at night. Finally, there is a fierce and abiding loyalty, made of living, working, fighting together. I knew, once accepted into the squat, that whatever happened, no one there would ever deliberately let harm come to me. And my comrades knew that I was committed to them in the same manner. This, of all things, proves the worth of living in common, in commune. Physical, emotional, spiritual safety in the world is a joke perpetuated by the social enemy. How much better do anarchists do it? Face to face, the commitment becomes real, a material thing, not some nightmare. The uniformed assholes threatening prison, parole, and degradation. I'll take the threat of several black-clad figures in the middle of the night, acting on conscience to help a comrade, over a cop loaded with laws and punishments. Some of the squatters are guests, visiting from almost every point on Earth, primarily Europe, France, Spain, Italy, Germany, and the U.S. Others are long-term, mostly Greek, and the occasional American. Almost everyone takes turns prepping food and sitting at an early morning defense shift, the only two real chores at the squat. Everything else is pretty much left to chance, cleaning the toilets, sweeping, mopping common areas, emptying ashtrays, occasionally standing outside in the street when things in Exarchia get tense, and making tea or sweets for the assembly. This arrangement overburdens some folks and it underburdens others, which is the nature of non-coercive social relations, something to be accepted, not denied, not decried. It's the way things are. The squad I found myself in is considered one of the blackest, meaning the most explicitly political squatters are either anarchist individualists or nihilists. Other squads tend to be less black, more red, meaning anarcho-communist, syndicalist, or some stripe of collectivist. Some of the finer points of theory are abandoned in favor of the nature of the relationships that the different squads or squatters have developed over the years. Perhaps an overstatement, but a balance of animosity and agreement reigns between the squads, sometimes forming alliances, occasionally coming to blows, which is one of the reasons that the December 6, 2016 riot was so significant, where personal and political grudges were shelved in favor of an all-out, coordinated effort at defending the community from police incursion. Even the authorities registered surprise in the mainstream media after the night of rioting, going so far as to authorize a few patrols near Exarchia Square by cops in armored jeeps. This presence was quickly curtailed, the authorities realizing that the provocation was hardly worth the potential backlash. In fact, only one squat bowed out of the defense of Exarchia, and it came under criticism for what was seen as a real inability to play well with others. "Motherfuckers, I said food!" The reminder, this time registered with some anger by the cook, is greeted with muted derision and groaning by the residents. It's early by squatter's time, 1 p.m., and those left in the building are sleeping. I drag myself out of bed, force down a coffee and maybe a plate of food. It's good. Potatoes, rice, salad, and some kind of fried meat. Could be seafood. Eel, maybe. I talked to the cook later that day and asked about the meat. She said, "Sheep cheeks and tongue. Good, right?" I smiled and said, "Really good. Thanks." Like the meal, living in the commune is like that. The more you try new stuff, the better it gets. You're charging power to your aim. And now we're full of energy. We are the robots. On this week's What is Anarchism section, the question, what are anarchist criticisms of science and technology? To provide an answer, a longtime commenter named Autumn Leaves Cascade responds at length. A green anarchist critique of science. Humans use processes where we start from experience, form conjectures, and then test predictions based on tentative explanations. We compare results with peers. Our evolution of trekking, foraging, tracking, hunting all involve this process. These things constitute a form of science. While even this encounters the problem of induction, the problem of the uncertainty of the future remaining despite previously clear experiences, the dominant culture embraces a distinct form of science that has its own features. Harmful features. Empire has a specific form of science. Imperial science begins by attempting to remove the actual physical world from the understanding by the use of a sterile laboratory to disconnect, isolate, and reassemble parts. These attempts can expedite access to certain claims on knowledge, but devalue intimacy, participation, and co-determination, which leads to narcissism and over time cultivates hostility to aliveness and wildness. Imperial science conceals its implicit values and filters observability, detachment, objectifiability, quantifiability, predictability, controllability, uniformity, proclaims itself neutral, and discards or disciplines the anomalies and mysteries that do not fit in its framework, potentially demolishing their immense subject's subjective worth. Imperial science prefers unidirectional cause and effect understandings, while ignoring interdependent, co-determining connections. Imperial science possesses a bias towards instruments and numbers, and assumes a disparate, mechanistic universe. It also implicitly maintains the philosophical system of Western rationality, which reasons through the use of hierarchical binary opposites, for instance, subject-object, mind-body, matter-spirit, masculine-feminine, even if reality does not always fit into such a perspective. And imperial science pushes itself as the only acceptable path to understanding. Imperial science divides accessibility to methodologies and tools by specialization and class, creating a priestly class of expert authorities that mediate to the public the discovered truth of the universe. With imperial science, a small professional cadre actively confines deeper understanding to within their own compartment through models and instruments beyond the layperson's awareness or access. It moves ever further towards abstraction, beyond the layperson's ability to confirm or refute, developing characteristics of religious dogma. Imperial science divorces itself from ecological ethics, instead embracing exclusively proposed utilitarian to certain human cultures. It attempts to magnify control over life forms and land bases, and further human pursuit of all knowledge regardless of the cost, sometimes accepting white humans, or all humans, otherwise not. Facilitating the self-destructive project of domination, quote, "Welcome to the Machine," page 41, Aronowitz speaking, "the point of science," and this may not be true of individual scientists, "is to make the world subject to human domination. If they can abstract, and they can predict on the basis of that abstraction, then they can try, at both the human and natural levels, to use that prediction in order to exert control. Genetic engineering is a great example, although almost any field will work as well. The ideology underlying its conceptualization is that we cannot and will not depend on nature to yield its own productivity, both in terms of its own development and human need. We're going to intervene, because the process of maturation has to be faster. The output has to be more plentiful, production has to be cheaper, humans have to be more in control of the process," end quote. Imperial science promotes the human exceptionalism responsible for leading us to long-term disaster, planetary biotic collapse. But forms of comprehension do not have to yield forms of domination. Humans also use very unscientific elements to successfully make decisions. Intuition, instinct, imagination, inspiration, associations. And we cannot objectively quantify such things as personality. For instance, the propensity for self-care, attitude, for instance, optimism or pessimism, self-esteem, the desire for preservation, stress, subjective perception of pain, or willpower, how determined one feels. These fundamentally unscientific elements of decision-making and character prove essential to our own wellness, but imperial science pushes them to the margins. Cultures with other forms of science, however, respect these elements' place and value. These elements also do not usually or even often fit solidly within the science or religious dichotomy. We cannot reduce these decision-making features or influences upon the world to someone's belief or non-belief in an invisible sky daddy or magic man, and yet they remain unscientific. Imperial science can certainly help us understand certain information and trends. Industrial science especially, because it comes at a devil's bargain of sacrificing any other consideration. We know how calories work because the Nazis wanted to know how little they could feed Jewish death camp laborers. Calories do exist as a concept measuring a phenomena and might yield useful insights, but we cannot reduce the understanding to just numbered measurements. And viewing life forms, landscapes, or the totality of matter in solely utilitarian lenses enables abuse. Imperial science has no conflict with, and in fact has higher compatibility with, for instance, Nazism, whereas the hunting methods of traditional indigenous people, intimately entwined to their land bases, based at least in some part on empiricism, testing educated guesses, and peer review, have no receptiveness to practices that disregard their spiritual place as members of an interdependent web. We must not accept the reasoning behind attempts to grind up everyday life in machine gears just to squeeze out some new insight that will further a subsection of humans' control of the world. Imperial science tries as long as possible to avoid philosophical and ethical challenges as a litany of experiments with coerced use of surgery, pathogens, radiation, psychological torture, physiological torture, and pharmaceuticals under the guise of necessary research for confirm from antiquity to modernity. Empire makes science a heartless terror. Intimacy and balance put it back in its rightful place. Finally tonight, to learn more. This week we released a brand new episode for the month of February of A-Tubes, our digest of the anarchist tubes. To learn more about anarchism, We have an Introduction to Anarchism Q&A site at anarchy101.org. If you would like books and other anarchist material, littleblackcart.com. Most of the references within this podcast have been at the same place where you can get up-to-the-minute commentary on local and weekly and up-to-the-minute anarchistnews.org. My personal podcast is at thebrilliant.org. Our email address is podcast@anarchistnews.org, and look forward to seeing you again next week.